Irving Adato. Yisrael ben Rachel Adato. There's a hole which is very wide today, not only for Irv, but because his beloved wife Vivian is not here. How much she wants to be here, and we send a refuah shlema to her, we send her speedily wishes of good health to her, and we're thinking of her as she is thinking of us. We're recording this today, that she can hear it, and our thoughts are with her as she recovers. Irv, a loving husband to Vivian, father to Stephen, to Shelley and Alan Baumgarten, and to Ross and Alan Bornstein, grandfather to Rebecca, Miriam, Abby, Marco, and Ella. Irving Adato was born April 30th, 1920, the third child born to Rachel and Solomon Adato. He grew up in the central district of Seattle in the old Sephardic neighborhood, going to Sephardic Bikur Cholim congregation, a member for 96 years. He attended Pacific Grade School and Garfield High School. After high school, Irv trained as a barber. He worked for a short time as a barber and then joined the National Guard and spent 5 years in the Army with 2 years in Australia during World War II. He had a lot of fond memories of his adventures in Australia. And over the short time that I was in Seattle these past 3 years, he'd always fondly spend memories about that time, his adventures and his misadventures, his one time going to Melbourne and seeing Senator McCarthy. He had some great stories about his time there. Irv was a radio operator in the Army, and after Australia, he was sent to Fort Sill in Oklahoma to train others to use Morse code. After the war, Irv met Vivian when Vivian worked in the flowers, when Irv worked in the flower store, which was located next door to Vivian's music store, where she was working in. And luck was have it, she went to visit a cousin, but her cousin wasn't there, so she had Irv was behind the counter. And Irv, when he finished taking the order, he goes, "Just one more thing, I have a rose to place on your sweater." And Irv hoped that would be enough, but it wasn't. So he went to see Vivian a few weeks later, and he bought a radio phonograph console. And I wasn't sure what this was, so I looked it up last night on Google Images. So I have an image of what it's like, one of those old radio tape. I know what it is now. They were very, very expensive, and Irv had to make a number of payments. But I really think the reason why he went for the multiple payments because he could regularly go back and have an excuse to go visit Vivian. Shortly after that, they began dating, and 6 months later they were engaged, and then they were married on February 11th, 1951, and they had three children, Steve, Shelley, and Ross. Irv was only in the flower shop a short time, and perhaps it was fate that short time he was there was when Vivian and Irv got time to meet. So as I said before, he was trained as a barber, and it was that he went back into, and he was a corporate barber, serving as the barber for Boeing, and later for the Seattle Times, where most of us, if you asked what Irv did, we know it there. He was very proud of his barber. I remember once when I was visiting him recently, he said, "Rabbi, you need a shave." He also worked for the state of Washington licensing barbers and personally administering the exams throughout the state. And I also heard that Irv also had a real estate license too, which he liked to dabble in a little bit. Irv was a wonderful husband. In Vivian's words, life wasn't always easy. It had its ups and downs. But with Irv, it was never dull. He always made Vivian laugh. He had a quick wit, and he was really good with words. He loved language and literature. Irv was a very proud father and grandfather. And Irv got the best grandfather present ever when Abby, his third granddaughter, was born on his birthday. He loved his children. He took great care of you. He was a very comforting and competent father. He used to love to tell you stories and jokes and sing songs. He would tell great stories and he enjoyed writing them, both in English and in Ladino. It's important to remember his first language was Ladino. English came second, but you would never know that with how much he enjoyed his English. Irv was a proud member of the Ladineros, the Ladino class, which meets every Tuesday morning. It was one of those Tuesday morning sessions when I first arrived in Seattle. Ike Azo suggested to me, if I want to get to know the community, I didn't have a work visa at the time. So he said, maybe you should come to the Ladineros at 10:30 on a Tuesday. I said, I didn't have anything better on. So I went there, and one of the couples there who really made an impression on me was Irv and Vivian. Irv was a mainstay of the Ladino class for many, many years. He was one of the most knowledgeable members of the class, and he took great pleasure in participating in all of the sessions. And I believe he was actively going to that till just two weeks ago. He was still trying to make the sessions. Irv also loved the opera, poetry, going to lectures on Israel, politics, and going to concerts. But my defining image of Irv is his strength. He was such a strong and robust man with such wonderful physical health and well-being almost up until the end of his life. Has anyone heard of a man jumping at the age of 96? That was Irv, jumping at 96. Irv was a volunteer every Wednesday for many years at the Klein Galland home. He was one of the schmoozers. That's the title. How do you say that in Ladino? He was one of the charlachans.
Habladores.
He's a what?
Habladores.
He was a habladores. His job was to talk to the residents of the Klein, and he loved every moment there. Irv and Vivian, together with a few other couples, were instrumental in creating Shalom House, a home for Jewish disabled young adults, which would later become part of Jewish Family Services. And I think that that was something that Irv and Vivian were very proud of, what they were able to set up there. Irv was an active baker at Sephardic Bikur Cholim with Ellie Varon and Catherine Sharon, Tilly Halfen and Magda Shalom and many others. But he really enjoyed baking in the synagogue. Irv was an honest man, a man of real integrity. It was a trait that he held in high regard in others and something that he exemplified in all aspects of his life. He was a patient man. He was extremely stoic with his illness. He rarely complained and just took each day as a blessing. He was a man of few words, but when he spoke, you listened. His use of English was phenomenal. Indeed, his only regret was that he never went to university. He would love to have become an English literature professor. But most importantly, he loved his wife, and he was so proud of his children and his grandchildren. I will miss his exuberance and his zest for life. He had a way about him which he just wanted to be part of his life. Shetehe nishmato tzurura b'tzur chayim b'gan Eden. Amen. Ken hi ratzon. I'm going to ask Alan Bornstein to come up, and he's going to introduce the grandchildren.
Thank you. First, thank all of you for being here with our beloved and marvelous Irv. And I know that Vivian appreciates it greatly that you're here. Just to be in the presence of Irv and family. You know, Irv never experienced the troubles of old age. You'll say he was 96, and chronologically he was. But, you know, through his 96 years, he obtained the benefits and wisdom of living a long life, but never the troubles. He had a strong physical constitution, and that is a gift of heredity, but he used it. He was so supple. He glided and bounced when he walked, and he always walked at breakneck speed. Temperamentally, he never acted like an old man, despite his age, 96. He was always positive. He viewed people of different generations really as an opportunity just to share different viewpoints from a different perspective. And really to him, that was a collection of people as to how he and others could view the world and exchange their viewpoints. This outlook, the temperamental outlook, in part was a gift. For the physical constitution, that's a gift of heredity. But the temperamental, his temperament, that's really a gift of Vivian, who can't be with us today. So it's nice that they shared that. Now, who kept this positive outlook so that he could avoid, well, I'll say, the troubles of old age? And that was his grandchildren. There's five of them. There's Shelley and Alan's son. I mean, daughters. Sorry. No one's transgendered. But Abby and Alan and my kids. What he saw through them, he saw the reason I think he wasn't troubled with aging is that he saw himself continuing through them. And there were sort of, I say, three precepts that he inculcated and shared with them. One was the love of Judaism. And he did that quietly, but it was there. It was done durably but subtly. And I think indicative of that would be really Shabbat dinners or Pesach. Those were always marvelous events. Second precept that I think he inculcated, again, subtly and durably, was his love of Israel. Now, interestingly, his name is Israel. So I think first there was an element of self-love. I mean, he liked himself. He was proud of who he was. But also the people of Israel, and then also the modern state of Israel, which really is a miracle. He had a great appreciation of history. And in fact, he was sort of walking, talking history. He's 96, so to put this in context, his bar mitzvah was 1 month after Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in as President of the United States in 1933. And so for those around him, you know, he was a source of history, but he appreciated, and it really tied well to the first two issues, which was Judaism and the State of Israel, because through him, you understood the context of who you were, from where you came, and then where you were headed. So that's Irv. So now we have the five grandkids, and some of them would love to speak. I mean, it's difficult to speak at a funeral, particularly if someone who you love dearly, but they'll do their best. Thank you.
So I wasn't going to say anything today because I get quite emotional, but I saw this pillar here that says, "Do unto me kindness and truth." And so I want to start by saying that my grandpa was one of my best friends. In one of our last conversations, I asked him, "Papu, do you have any advice for me?" And he looked at me and smiled and said, "Follow the golden rule, which is to do unto others as you would do unto yourself." So I think that's very fitting, and I think we can all be a little kinder and empathize more. So that was a great lesson that I learned from him. Thank you.
Not to be naughty, but I think my papa would want me to start this speech by saying, "I suppose you are all wondering why we are gathered here today." Most people carry in their phones a vast collection of photographs of a chosen family member for whom they have a special adoration. They like to share these photos with friends with much cooing and laughter in the hopes of starting a fan club. Often the subject of fawning is a small child or baby, but for me it was my papu because he was a ham and much cuter than any baby I've ever seen. In addition, he had the advantage of being able to throw a dirty limerick for any furtive grin or monkey face that I could catch on camera. And truly, his greatest charm was the ability to orate stills of life, both mundane and profound, through a comedic lens. For example, about 15 years ago, my papu fell in a parking lot and broke his arm. He had to wear a sling for a month, which is conspicuous and begs for others to ask, "What happened?" My papu must have found the backstory of this whole ordeal to be terribly boring to repeat, because he crafted a very convincing story for his friends that he broke his arm while riding on a horse on his ranch in New Mexico. My papu reveled in telling tall tales. We were never sure what was true and what he mixed in for our entertainment. Did he really catch a kangaroo in Australia when serving in the army during World War II? Did he really rescue a lost Saudi child in the airport whose parents, in thanks, gave him the recipe for his famous tabbouleh? But it doesn't really matter what was true. Aristotle did not believe comedy to be a particularly mimetic form of art. Comedy does not imitate life. Rather, its purpose is to relay the good fortune of its characters. When he reimagined stories of the past, Papu always wanted us to feel fortunate, to see life as being light, being happy. This remained true even when we sat around his bedside last week and asked him, "What trait would you wish for all of us?" Asking for last wisdoms is a bit heavy, and from him we were not expecting a very serious answer. So we were surprised when he replied, "Oh, would some power, the gift to give us, to see ourselves as others see us." But a moment later he added, "Gee, I can't remember what poem that's from." A quick Google search revealed Robert Burns' poem titled "To a Louse on Seeing One on a Lady's Bonnet at Church." Comedy was my grandfather's sacred space, and a space I find suddenly empty now that he is no longer with us. My intent and request from all of you today is to gather comedic muses, be they the sticky smiles of babies on phones, dirty limericks, or the small daily pleasures, and to capture the lightness of life in his honor. Thank you.
My papu really is one of my greatest role models. What stood out the most to me, besides his jokes and barber skills, was his temperament. I never once saw him angry or upset, ever, when I was around him. On a good or a bad day, he would always be joyous to see me, whether it was playing baseball in his backyard, ping pong in his basement, or shooting hoops into his late 80s. He always seemed attentive and excited to spend time with me. He treated all of his family with the same joy and playfulness, and I really took this to heart. As I continue to grow, I aspire to be like him. I remind myself every day to follow Papu's footsteps and cherish each moment with my family and friends. Thanks.
So my older sister wasn't able to be here today, but she sent me something that she'd like me to say. Okay. I love you, Papu, so much. You helped shape who I am today. I hope you are proud of what I'm doing. I dedicate my course to you. You'll be in my heart throughout my whole service. Papu would always quote different famous writers and poets, and my favorite was when he'd quote Edgar Allan Poe, and he could recite The Raven by heart completely. And so for those who don't know, the first stanza goes, "Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door." And when we were all little and we'd be sitting at their table at their house in Seward Park, and when he said the gently rapping part, he'd knock underneath the table, and he just had this ability to make everything come to life, and we'd be so delighted and enthralled in his stories. And through his imagination, our worlds became a more magical place. And as we get older, it might be like the magic might disappear a little bit, but with him, he instilled in us the desire to go and find magic in the world today. And I will always be grateful for that.
Johnny?
Hey, well, first of all, I want to thank you all so much for coming. It really means a lot to me and my family, our greater family. So really, I'm quite touched, and I'm not surprised because my father was such an incredible, wonderful human being and father. And I want to talk today a little bit about him as a father and what that meant to me. Okay, so "be that as it may" is an expression that my father used all the time. And although I don't believe that he ever intentionally used it as a parenting tool, those words nevertheless had a lot of power when he spoke them to me, and they had a great impact on me growing up as the kid smack dab in the middle between my very extra special older brother Steve and my highly, extraordinarily gifted and most extraordinary younger sister, Roz. My father had a very fine sense of knowing when someone was what someone or how someone was feeling, even if that person tried hiding it as deeply as possible. He also had an incredible ability to know the difference between right and wrong and good and evil. My dad knew the fine balance of how not to hurt others, yet maintain his position, and that was so important to me, seeing that as a great role model growing up. Growing up, I remember him saying things to me like, "Shelley, I know you're upset, but be that as it may, you need to apologize." Or, "Shelley, you may in fact be correct, but be that as it may, you still need to acknowledge the other person's feelings and thoughts." And he was right. He was spot on right. Because in both cases, he was teaching me the importance of making right. So, "be that as it may" is a phrase that continues to stick to my ribs. By hearing it, I learned the importance of treating others with respect and dignity, two important traits that are so necessary for healthy relationships. For this, I thank my very lucky stars that I am my father's daughter. Because "be that as it may" was so critical to my growth and development over the years, I found myself and still find myself using the expression with my own children, Abby, our little combat soldier in the Israeli army, and Ella, a budding scientist and physician at the University of Montana. I use "be that as it may," using my father's very words, as a loving guide in teaching my children the importance of becoming independent, strong, caring individuals, and establishing healthy relationships. So when I think about it, I'm still blown away by how powerful those five little words are, and how my dad, a truly sublime person, helped me become the person I am today. So, Dad, if you can hear me, which I think you can, although you are no longer with us, be that as it may, I will cherish and love you eternally and will always keep the memory of you very close to my heart. Thank you.
Alan?
I'm the only one who's going to require some electronic assistance here with an iPad. I'm not sure if it's good to go last. I think in this case it's... Do you hear me? Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Irving Adato. Irving Adato was my father-in-law for more than 22 years. He seemed to be okay with having as a second son-in-law an Ashkenazi Jew named Alan, with the last name starting with B. He was really a gentleman, one who never seemed to raise his voice, certainly not according to the standards of the East Coast. During his final illness, I never heard him complain. He displayed dignity and strength. When I think of Irving, I think of the following, and there's a lot more than this, but this is a short list. Hair, dogs, green thumb, tabbouleh, grandchildren, boyhood in Seattle, storytelling. Hair. After he retired from barbering, he kept a barber's chair in the basement. He was the last professional barber to cut my hair. I managed to stay well enough on his good side so that I was never concerned when he gave me a haircut that I would really be in for a close shave. Dogs. He loved dogs. He was knowledgeable about many different breeds. He could have been a dog whisperer. And maybe he was. He never tired of telling about the dogs he knew or dogs he had had. And we had a miniature dachshund named Daisy May. As smart as Daisy was, dachshund was not Irving's favorite breed. One time when it would have been very convenient for us to leave Daisy with Irving and Vivian, I knew I had to convince Irving to take her in for the day. My ploy was to tell him that Daisy had tapped out with her paw her three favorite letters in the English language, IRV. Daisy stayed with Irving and Vivian that day. Green thumb. He was proud of the espaliered Hanukkah menorah attached to the side of the house of Seward Park South. That was one item. Another, Irving restored to life the orchid that we had brought back from our honeymoon in Hawaii. I left it in intense direct sunlight and it withered. Irving knew exactly how to care for it and it thrived, even to the point where he had to break it into three separate plants. They had it at their house for many years and returned it to us when they moved to the summit. It produces as many as 35 blossoms at a time. So it'll always remind me of him. Also, when they moved to the summit, I was able to take some yard tools, and when I used those, I certainly think of Irving. Tabuli. Irving made a great, wherever it came from, he made a great lemon mint tabuli that he prepared for family get-togethers, and I would request that he bring that to our house for dinners. And he did. He was very good about that. Grandchildren. Well, you saw four of the five who spoke just a few minutes ago. He recorded their heights on the end of one of the kitchen walls as they were growing up. I wouldn't have marked up my walls purposely, but he did. He was very proud to do that. And he was very proud of them all. Boyhood in Seattle. I never tired of asking him what it was like here when he was growing up. He got to take the ferry, for example, to Mercer Island before there was a bridge to go hiking and camping. You know, it seemed so exotic. Sounded to me like he grew up in a summer camp, although I know that it is easy to romanticize from the distance of time. Storytelling. So this was alluded to earlier. He was a great storyteller. He also liked to tell jokes, but ones that were not one-liners. His jokes required development. He drew you in with a story, used his dramatic voice to great effect, and then he popped a punchline as appropriate. We never could get enough of the storytelling. We were never tired of reruns. We would say, tell us the one about, because we'd already heard it, you know, many times before, but it was never old. So, here's one about a lemon meringue pie. Actually, boyhood in Seattle had its challenges, so it wasn't all easy, summer camp. One time, his mother gave him 5 or 10 cents for doing something around the house. He went to a local bakery and spent his entire windfall on a lemon meringue pie. He took it outside and sat down on a pile of wood and proceeded to eat the whole thing. He probably had not planned to eat the whole thing in one sitting, but one bite led to another. That was the last lemon meringue pie he ever ate. What a lesson. I, in all the years I knew him, I never saw him overeat. So, Australia Army story, so that was alluded to earlier as well. We would tell Irving, tell us a story about the time you shot the kangaroo. That was the time he went out with his captain, I think it was a captain, an officer, at night to shoot kangaroos. It was the officer's idea, not Irving's idea. Irving was supposed to be the jeep driver. The captain couldn't steady the rifle to bring down any of the kangaroos that were bounding across the undulating terrain, and Irving would do this. He would depict exactly, you know, the shape of that terrain illuminated by the moon. The captain ordered Irving to switch roles with him at that point, and now Irving had the job of shooting the kangaroo. And it was not a job that he really, he wasn't happy about getting it, but he hadn't saw it, he had no stomach for it. At one point, Irving closed his eyes, pulled the trigger, and managed to shoot one. All they brought back was the tail. So the kangaroo was left, but they brought the tail back, wrapped in paper. Irving brought it to the army cook the next morning. The cook, a hairy fire plug of a man, told him to get that thing out of here. So that was the story of the kangaroo, and didn't lead to any good. But it was repeated many, many times and never got old. Dream. Now, there was one night Shelley and I were over there, and Irving had this dream, and it was about it had to do with people in a car on an ice floe in a lake at Hanukkah singing Hanukkah songs. And I had never heard anything more hilarious. So he told the story, this dream, which is really like a story. And I instantly regretted that I hadn't recorded it. It was a classic in the style of Garrison Keillor, for those of you who know Prairie Home Companion, Garrison Keillor's Tales from Lake Wobegon, Minnesota. It was that kind of a story, and I always regretted that we hadn't recorded it, and I hadn't gotten him to write it down after that. It was an incredible story. And there were other stories, the time he was a rancher, and the time he met the Saudi prince. And then there was a Greek worker in the Pike Place fish market. And anyway, there were tremendous stories, and those will all stay with us. I know I will miss him, and we will all miss him.
When I think of my dad, I think of the song Clair de Lune, Light of the Moon, or Moonlight, composed by Claude Debussy. As you know, in the middle of the night, the light of the moon opens darkness and illuminates the wonder and splendor of nature. It's a beautiful gift of God. My dad listened to Clair de Lune his last night of life. Like the moon, he too cast a luminous light around him, reminding me of all that I loved and still love most about him. My dad was a beautiful man, humble and modest, a man who loved his wife, family, friends, and the classic arts. He devoted himself to his beloved Ladino, literature, especially poetry, opera, and writing. In his last few years, he turned his focus from the violent or profane news of the day to the beauty of the arts. One of his utmost pleasures was to watch the Classic Arts TV channel number 75. He delighted in all that was playful and whimsical, yet highly artistic. He loved, for example, Doll's Song from the opera The Tales of Hoffmann, in which a mechanical doll must be wound up in order to sing like a gorgeous soprano. He loved to quote lines from poems and songs that inspired him. While some of his favorite poets included the masters Milton, Sir Walter Scott, and Robert Burns, he also quoted old-time comedians like Danny Kaye. Don't forget, give him the fist, give him the wrist, give him the finger. He was strong and dignified. I'll miss the way he wore his freshly laundered button-down shirts, his chinos and baseball cap, and shaving always mattered. Walking briskly, he often seemed at least 20 years younger. Even in his last few months of life, we enjoyed walking at the park, the Fry Museum, and Golden Gardens. But treating others with dignity also really mattered to him. A favorite memory of this is a time when I dropped my dad off in front of the summit. As he got out of the car, a man approached. The man looked unkempt and suspicious, maybe ravaged by drug abuse. I instinctively became worried he might harm my 96-year-old dad in some way, so I watched their encounter before I drove off. I saw them engage in some banter for a few moments, and then the stranger started to laugh and walked away. I later asked what they had talked about and what made the man laugh. My dad shared that the man had asked him his age. My dad then asked the man his age. And upon learning his age, my dad said, "Oh, you're 50. I have neckties older than you." He used comedy to lighten others. The darkness of the world often bewildered him, and with a sigh, he would shake his head and say, "Oh, what a world we live in." Yet with fortitude, humor, and dignity, he lit a luminous path like moonlight of how to love and live fully.
Vivian made a special request that Chazan Ezos to sing a Ladino romance called Dorne Dorne, and I told Chazan, and Chazan said, if it's okay with me, then I'll do it for Vivian. So, Aik b'chavod, Dorne Dorne.
If I can say just a couple more words myself, I sent an email out to all the members of the Ladino class last night, and I got a couple back this morning. I'd like to read them. One of them was from Professor David Bunas, who taught at the University of Washington a couple of years ago. Enjoyed coming to class as well. Queridos Ladineros, dear Ladineros, me atristí mucho de amusar de la petira del querido Urbedaros y Rono de Raja. I was very saddened to hear about the passing of our dear Irving Adaro. May his memory be for blessing. Tuve mucho placer de hablar con él unas cuantas veces. I had much pleasure to speak with him a few times cuando estuve en Seattle antes dos años, when I was in Seattle 2 years ago. Su petirá es una grande piedrita para la comunidad judía de Seattle. His passing is a great loss for the Jewish community of Seattle y para todos los que lo conocían a Irv and all those that knew Irv. Vosotros que vivas, may you all live sanos y recios, hale and hearty, con salud cumplida, with total health y haberes buenos and good news. Amen. Con querencia, with affection, David Bunas. And the other one was from a classmate of ours, Luis Antezana. Me ha criado, and he's writing this in pure Spanish. That's his fallback. Me has creado un dolor difícil de aguantar. You have created a very difficult pain that I can't bear. Irv, que junto contigo fue el amigo más querido del grupo, who together with you was the most dear friend of the group. Siempre con una sonrisa en la cara, always with a smile on his face, y unas palabras de amistad en los labios, and words of friendship on his lips. Qué dolor siento, what a pain I feel. Estaré en el cementerio, I hope to be at the cemetery. Pero estoy seguro, but I'm sure, que él nos mira con esa sonrisa en la cara, cuidado por Dios, that he is looking down on us with this smile on his face, taken care of by God. It's only because Viv asked for this that I'm doing it. I've never done this before at a funeral. Durme, durme, hermosa doncella. Durme, durme, sin ansia y dolor. Durme, durme, sin ansia y dolor. Que tu esclavo, que tanto desea ver tu sueño con grande amor, ver tu sueño con grande amor. Hay dos años que sufre mi alma, por ti joya, mi linda dama. Por ti joya, mi linda dama. Siente, siente al son de mi guitarra. Siente, hermosa, mis males
cantar. Siente hermosa mis males cantar. ¿Quién es este que abaixa la huerta con un cestico arrancar la flor? Con un cestico arrancar la flor. Durme, durme, hermosa doncella. Durme, durme, sin ansia y dolor. Durme, durme, sin ansia y dolor.
I'd just say one more thing, that this friend from the class took some pictures at the birthday party, the 95th birthday party that was given for Irv last year at the summit. One of them happens to be a picture of Irving, along sitting next to Professor Devin Narr, and I'm in the back with my arms on their shoulders. I'll be happy to send it to the family.